I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown, with my second show of the week, and then the flagship edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Blog Talk Radio.
Wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
From the Polyester Pleasure Palace on the shores of Lake Washington, or as close as I can get in my price range, it's Jim Valley. The name of the show is Wrestling Road Stories. When the beer was cold, the rats were hot, people believed it was real, and we sold out everywhere. Everywhere. Wrestling Road Stories is about our love for wrestling, that communal experience that we've all experienced, whether it was going to the matches or seeing Razor Ramon for the first time on television and going, "What the hell is Scott Hall doing?" Of course, that wouldn't be the first time we'd ever say in our lives, "What the hell is Scott Hall doing?" Wrestling Road Stories, the wrestling of your childhood, whether you grew up in the territory days or the pay-per-view era or no matter what. But remember, no matter when you grew up, as long as you're listening to the show, just remember this one thing. What's your next question, Kylan?
Okay, question number two.
Are you drunk? No, Kylan is not drunk, but I think this guy is.
Hey, this is the Nature Boy Ric Flair looking for Jim, by God, woo, Valley. Hey, Jim, I know you're the man. You are Jim, woo, by God, Valley. And I'm Ric Flair, 14-time World Heavyweight Champion, and telling you, Jim Valley, you are, woo, the man.
Thank you for being a part of Wrestling Road Stories each and every Wednesday here on the PW Torch Livecast. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley, J-I-M-V-A-L-L-E-Y. Why? Because I like you. You can also follow me on Facebook. And you know what? After I mentioned last week to send me a message, so I know that you're not a webcam girl, guess who I added last week? A webcam girl. Thought she was like a friend of a friend, and she turned out to be a webcam girl. No, we do not add webcam girls. What you do in your private life is your business, but no webcam girls for me. So last week, what a fun show with Tony Schiavone, and I hope that I was able to bring out that side of Tony Schiavone that I know and love. I mean, that guy, he's great in person on his podcast on What Happened When Mondays with Conrad Thompson, but in person he's even better. So if he continues to do live shows, go out and see him in person, because once he knows that the crowd laughs and he's hooked to the crowd, he is like, you know, like a shark reacting to chum. He just keeps going, and he'll tell just these increasingly crazy and funny and outrageous stories, and it's great. And I tried to bring out some of that last week with the Ric Flair story. And now I know for sure that you're going to watch the Ric Flair 30 for 30, but this time you're going to watch it to see if Tony Schiavone's on there and to see if he's going to talk about Ric Flair's privates. We'll find out. Also, the Jimmy Valiant story with Tony Falk was pretty funny. And then I am excited for Tony Schiavone's T-shirt at the greatest hit night in the history of our sport. Why that isn't already a T-shirt, I don't know. Seems obvious, but, you know, sometimes you have the forest between the trees. And I hope Tony does put that together and make that happen, because I'd like to see Tony make some more money. He's a nice guy. Speaking of nice guys, on the show today, Brennan Martin. He is the cousin of Jeff Jarrett. He would be the nephew of Jerry Jarrett, and he is the grandson of Christine Jarrett. Now, if you're around the Nashville area and you go to the Nashville Fairgrounds, you'd see Christine Jarrett was the ticket taker there back in the day at the fairgrounds. And I know, like, when people talk about her, Meltzer and other people and stuff, they always refer to her as just the ticket taker, and they didn't talk so much about her real behind-the-scenes role. Well, there's a book out. It's called Teeny, Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame, and it's by Brennan Martin, who is the son of Christine Jarrett's daughter. And it's a great book, and it goes full circle. This is the kind of book it is. It goes full circle with the Fabulous Ones in their van in the parking lot of a Coliseum, and it goes full circle around that story. And it also has a wrestling bear in it. It talks about Nick Gulas and Roy Welch and the Fuller end of the Tennessee Territory and how that split happened, and it explains a lot of things that were always a little vague. I don't know about you, but the whole Fuller, Welch, Gulas territory, how that whole thing worked out, it was always a little bit vague to me. And this thing even has the story of how Roy Welch and Nick Gulas met, and it involves a wrestling bear. So there's some good stories in here. But it's also a story about a woman of the age of the greatest generation. And I don't know about you. I'm a Gen Xer. And I'm all about equality. And whatever you want to do, if it's legal and whatever, I'm fine with it. I'm all about freedom. But there is one thing with the advent of, like, the Wonder Woman movie and stuff, which, again, I think is great. I believe there's, like, a generation behind us who thinks, like, they're the ones who broke all this new ground and, like, until they came along, like, women were all in the kitchen and we were just the worst people in the world. And I'm not saying there couldn't have been improvements or there couldn't have been growth, but here yet is another example for the kids of what I guess the kids would call today a strong woman. And a great example. I mean, she raised her kids basically by herself. And she started out as, you know, working in a bank and working at a Woolworths, which is sort of like a JCPenney, which is sort of like a Walmart, I guess. Pretty soon we're going to have to explain what JCPenney is. But that's another story altogether. But, and then she got connected with the wrestling promotions, and she started, you know, managing the books, and then she started managing a few of the towns, and, you know, she made quite a bit of money all on her own, all doing all of these things. And so when the kids talk about how there were no female role models and there were no this, I want to point to books like this and go, look, see, there were. We weren't all the biggest monsters like you kids want to make us out to be. And don't get me wrong, I'm happy that kids have role models and you can be whatever you want to be in this world. But there certainly were examples of that prior to just recently. That's my point. So this book is great. We'll talk to the author, Brennan Martin, in just a few minutes. But you should definitely get this book. This will open up your eyes to a lot of things regarding Memphis wrestling and Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Jarrett. And when you read the book, even though the book doesn't say it explicitly, you'll see some stories and you'll kind of get an idea, and it'll kind of put into focus, you know, maybe some things in the recent history that Jeff Jarrett did and Jerry Jarrett did and their business decisions. And some of the things that they have done, you know, publicly and promotionally will make more sense to you because now you'll have more of a background on their history. And so much of what they got is from Teeny Jarrett. So we'll talk about that coming up in just a few minutes here with Brennan Martin. But before we get going, if you haven't watched Memphis Wrestling, Memphis Wrestling may be my favorite wrestling. And thanks to YouTube, I've watched pretty much all of it. If you go on YouTube, you can find, for a lot of years, virtually every episode, week by week, in Memphis. You know, it starts out slow. There's like an early episode from 79. There's a handful of episodes from 80. There's a few from 81. And as it gets deeper and deeper, you get more and more episodes. And by the early to mid-80s, you pretty much have every episode there as VCRs became more common and people have shared their content online. But if you go to YouTube, I would watch Memphis Wrestling in order because it's the best. It's just the best. And it's a great example of, you know, the point of wrestling is to build characters and to build people up, and then you have the payoff at the end. And, you know, and I think I've used this example. You know, people say, oh, Lita or Trish Stratus were the greatest wrestlers, female wrestlers of all time. And certainly they had a great career. But, and certainly they appreciated wrestling and they worked hard in their own right. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of it was the promotion. But that's exactly what wrestling is and what wrestling is supposed to be. And there's nothing wrong with it. And Memphis epitomizes that because they obviously don't have a ton of money. And it's a lot of Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett's creativity to build up a lot of these journeyman wrestlers into something that was great. You know, guys like Don Bass, the Singing Cowboy, or the Dream Machine, Troy Graham. They took a Dusty Rhodes impersonator and made him one of my all-time favorite wrestlers. So there's so much great stuff on Memphis. Some of my favorite episodes, a legendary episode is the Bill and Buddy Show, where Bill Dundee and Buddy Landell were the big bad guys at the time in 86. And the week before, they struck Lance Russell, and that was something that never happened and something you just did not do. And so Lance refused to conduct their interview, so they had to do it by themselves, and they had to stay a certain distance away from Lance. So they bring out a desk, a makeshift desk that says the Bill and Buddy Show on it, and sit over on another stage and set up a whole announce desk and take over the show. And it's brilliant. I never understood why someone hasn't taken over Monday Night Raw in that regard. It leads to a great angle, so if you've never seen the Bill and Buddy Show, brilliant. Another thing is Fred Ottman, the Shockmaster, Typhoon. You know, before he went to pretty much anywhere else, he was in Memphis as Big Bubba. He sort of had an outfit, the red outfit, like Typhoon did. And rather than necessarily always being a scary, tough guy, he did a lot of dancing and wanted to show people what a great entertainer he was. And again, the thing about Memphis more than anything is you can draw a line from Memphis to sports entertainment. And I know some people will think that's blasphemy, but it's true. They have these crazy characters. You know, they did still talk about winning and losing and not just entertaining, but some of the crazy skits and the angles and everything. Memphis wrestling is sports entertainment, and it's the best. And I just love it. And I love Lance Russell and Tommy Rich and Jerry Lawler. You know, that's another thing. Jerry Lawler, the perennial champion, whether he was fighting for the Unified World title or the Southern title, you know, he would lose that title like every 2 weeks. And the story was just him regaining it every, you know, week to a month, maybe 2 months tops. You know, they talk about how title reigns need to last to matter. But Jerry Lawler is the exception to that rule because he talked about how important that title was and how important it was for him to get it back. And even though he held it literally hundreds of times. It still seemed important, and, you know, that was just the formula. But if you haven't watched Memphis Wrestling, it's on YouTube, and it's just Jimmy Hart is great. The First Family is great. I mean, they even take somebody who is not a good wrestler, like Chick Donovan, and they make something out of him. So they take all of these things because that's what they had the budget for and built all of it up. And it's just great. It really is. It's just the best. So we'll talk some Memphis wrestling here, and we will talk about Christine Jarrett, sort of the matriarch of Memphis wrestling, because really, when you look at Christine Jarrett, she's literally one of the most important figures in wrestling, because without her, there's no Jerry Jarrett. Without Jerry Jarrett, there's no Jerry Lawler. With Nick Gula still running the Tennessee territory, it probably would have died off. You know, really, she is sincerely one of the most historically significant people. And I'll bet you know nothing about her in this book, and hopefully some of this interview we're going to do in a few minutes will fill in the blanks. But it's a great interview I think we're going to have with Brennan Martin, and it's a very good book. I compare it to, you know, I'm making an old reference here, but a little bit of The Grapes of Wrath, because she came from such humble beginnings. Maybe a little bit of Paper Moon, again, kind of an older reference, but I can't think of any movies that really are quite as relatable to that. Anyway, it's Jim Valley. It is Wrestling Road Stories, and we're going to have some pretty fun Wrestling Road Stories here coming up in just a few minutes. So glad you joined me on this Wednesday afternoon show. We are here every Wednesday. We're here from 2 p.m. on the West Coast, 5 p.m. on the East Coast, or you can download us live at pwtorch.com. And also, if you want to get the show commercial-free, you can sign up at pwtorch.com/govip. So be sure to do that and check out all of the great content from Wade Keller and Bruce Mitchell and all the people that you know and love on the PW Torch, the website. So be sure and do that. That's why we're here, to let you know about that. All right, we're going to come back, talk to Brennan Martin in just a couple of minutes here on the PW Torch Livecast, Wrestling Road Stories with Jim Valley.
When you want to know when the next episode of the PW Torch Livecast is scheduled or catch up on a show you missed, check out our homepage, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can stream the latest shows right from that page, or download the show, or get a link to subscribe on a podcast app. That's pwtorchlivecast.com for the latest shows, and also catch up on shows you missed at pwtorchlivecast.com.
It's the PW Torch Livecast. It's Jim Valley, Wrestling Road Stories, here on this Wednesday, and we're dialing up Brennan Martin.
Brennan. Hey, Jim.
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm so glad we finally got to connect. Brennan and I were at the Cauliflower Alley Club, and I was busy doing some of the seminars and things, and Brennan was there selling his book in the meeting room where everybody meets at the Cauliflower Alley. And this is me saying this, not Brennan, because Brennan loves all people and all God's children. But there were times when I wanted to go over and meet Brennan. And as we know in wrestling, sometimes there are people who just want to talk and talk and talk. And after a while, you just get tired of these time suckers. And I left. But I'm sure you enjoyed it. But I was like, yeah, I can't wait, Brennan. I gotta go. But a few times I went
every
over there,
minute.
There were, yes, you did. But there were some time suckers that I just didn't want to deal with. But that's just the name of Cauliflower Alley sometimes. But what are you gonna do? Did you enjoy Cauliflower Alley?
I did. I enjoyed it very much. I had to laugh, though, because I spent 3 days sitting next to the gorgeous ladies of wrestling before I knew that they were going to be famous again with the new Netflix show, and I didn't manage to meet a single one of them.
I got the hook on the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. I could help you there if you need to.
Oh, that's okay. I just thought it was a missed opportunity.
You know what's so funny about that is, you know, the gorgeous lady, you know, the people back in when the gorgeous ladies wrestling was on the air, there is no way they would have gotten into the Cauliflower Alley Club. For right or for wrong,
no.
There is no way that would have happened. And don't get me wrong, I'm happy for them, but there's no way that they would have not gotten in. They wouldn't have gotten in the door.
Well, it certainly took some time to appreciate what they did and what they meant to wrestling, I suppose. To tell you the truth, before the Cauliflower Alley Club this year, I had never heard of them because I was not really a wrestling fan at that time and just didn't pay it any attention at all. And so my first exposure to them was in Las Vegas this year.
Well, they're all very nice ladies. And, you know, many of them have went on to live normal, happy lives. And this is nice that they're recognized. It was a big deal for a lot of them, then I know it was a very special weekend. So I don't want to besmirch them. I'm happy they got in, and I'm happy they're a part. They're certainly a credit to the Cauliflower Alley Club as it exists today. No doubt about it.
Absolutely.
So, Brennan, why don't you explain to everyone listening who you are?
All right. Well, it probably doesn't matter who I am so much as who my grandmother was. And so I'm the grandson of Christine Jarrett, the matriarch of the Jarrett wrestling family. And I've written a book about her life and sort of how she went from a very poor and challenging childhood existence to being one of the very few successful women wrestling promoters in the business.
Well, your mother is Christine Jarrett's daughter, or Jerry Jarrett's sister. So Jerry Jarrett would be your uncle, and Jeff Jarrett would be your cousin. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Teenie had had two children. Jerry, whom I would imagine everybody on this broadcast knows, and then my mother, Carolyn. And there were six grandchildren in all, and really it was the Jarrett side of the family, as in Jerry Jarrett, that has continued on in the tradition. But I have not been in the business at all, other than having researched and written this book.
Well, that was one of the things, and we'll get into some stories about your grandmother here, but I wanted to just kind of set the stage for everybody about you so they know where this information is coming from. You talk about how your cousin Jeff, who everybody knows, when he was very young, you know, a teeny took him out to some of the towns and showed him how everything ran from a business aspect. Did you ever have interest in that? Was that ever your cup of tea?
Well, I mean, it was, and just to be clear, you know, my mother went on those trips as well. Jerry was, you know, typically selling programs and sort of running around the arena doing what boys do, while my mother was in the concession stand or when she was very young, sort of sitting underneath the desk while Teeny sold tickets as people came in. And I only went on the circuit with Teeny once when I was growing up. It was about seventh grade. I was a big fan of Handsome Jimmy Valiant, and he had a thing going with Lawler at the time. And so it was one summer that I took the trip with Teeny to Louisville on Tuesday night, Evansville Wednesday night, and we went to Lexington on Thursday night, which was a monthly show. And that was actually the first time I met Jim Cornette. And that was really my only exposure to that side of the business. I mean, we'd been to the matches before, but I'd never really just been attached to Teeny's hip as she was running these shows. I did spend one summer when I was younger, at least one summer, spending a lot of time at the wrestling office in Nashville when Teeny was not on the road. Because my mother spent some time as a single mom, and that was some fairly cheap childcare for me, and I was good at staying out of the way. And so I couldn't tell you exactly how long that lasted, but I was around the business in that sense and did spend quite a lot of time at the office that one summer. I can remember regular trips across the street to Kentucky Fried Chicken to pick up lunch for folks, and then down the street to Captain D's. But generally it was just about sort of staying out of the way.
Back when Kentucky Fried Chicken was good.
Well, you know, I think they've been sort of doing the same thing for a long time. So, you know, I'm not going to disparage the Colonel at this point.
So obviously this is the territorial days. Teeny is old school came. I would imagine that she kayfabed the business to you. At what point did you get smart to the business, and did you ever get smart around her before you were supposed to?
Oh my gosh. It took me so long to smarten up, because my grandmother, who, as far as I was concerned, could tell no lies and do no wrong, she never broke kayfabe with me. There were times when I would get in, you know, playground arguments with my friends about whether wrestling was real. And I would go to her and ask her questions, but she always had a way of answering them in that she didn't outright lie, but she didn't fully tell the truth either. You know, for instance, I might say, you know, Teeny got in a fight with so-and-so at school. They said wrestling is fake and all that blood is fake. And she would say, now you listen to me. None of that blood is fake. When those men bleed in the ring, that is their real blood. And then she'd leave it at that. And so, you know, that was true. That was certainly true. Now, what she didn't tell me was that they were cutting themselves or that the outcome was predetermined or anything like that. But no, she absolutely never broke kayfabe with me. And the point at which I should have smartened up really was that trip that I took with her to Louisville, Evansville, and Lexington, because I kept seeing the same show several nights in a row. And it certainly seemed suspicious to me, but she had a way of explaining that away also, so that I was probably hearing what I wanted to hear, because I'd certainly been defending the business my whole life. At that point I was, 13 years old. I should have been smarter than I was, but I just, it really, to tell you the truth, it came as a huge disappointment to me when I was, again, several years older than that even, and Vince McMahon went on 2020 or whatever it was where he got interviewed and said, yeah, it's sports entertainment. That to me was highly disappointing. And of course, at that point, I felt like a real schmuck for not having known before then.
Yeah, but you loved your grandmother, and you had no reason not to believe her. And when someone that close to the business tells you that, then someone you love so dearly, of course you're going to believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I heard what I wanted to hear, and she was faithful to the business at all times. She didn't smarten anyone up. And I had a conversation about that with my cousin Jeff as well when I was interviewing him for the book, and asked him, I said, you know, did Teeny or your dad ever smarten you up? And he said, absolutely not. He said, I finally, I sort of figured it out once he moved out to Hendersonville, where Jerry had a house, and Jeff moved out there for a while after initially mostly living with his mom, who was Jerry's ex-wife, his first wife. But he said, after I moved out to Hendersonville and I saw, the guys would come over, and I figured out that, guys who hated each other in the ring did not necessarily hate each other when they're sitting in my living room. I kind of at that point realized what was going on, but he said, absolutely not. He said, Teeny never told me a thing, and neither did my dad.
We're talking with Brennan Martin. He's got a new biography on his grandmother called Teeny, Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame. It's all about Christine Jarrett, like you said, the matriarch of the Jarrett family. When you were writing the book, was there something that you learned that you didn't know? What was probably the most shocking thing or surprising?
Well, I had never heard the story before about Teeny and Jack Pfeffer.
And that is a great story.
I'm not going to get fully into that because I don't want to release any spoilers.
Right. Let me back up real quick. For those who don't know, Jack Pfeffer was Vince McMahon of his day 100 times worse. He was a carny's carny. And he would promote shows and use, Bruno San Martino on his show instead of Bruno San Martino. And he would run shows like that. He was one of the biggest scam artists and biggest liars, and actually probably the first person, like Vince McMahon did, to expose the business publicly. But Jack did it out of vengeance. So, okay, go ahead about Jack. But that is a great story, that how deathly responsible Teeny is for the disappearance of Jack Pfeffer, should we say.
Yeah, so Jack was shaking down all the territories. He would go in and basically blackmail or extort money out of the promoters, saying, if you don't pay me so much a week or a month, I'm going to pay for this town. Meaning he's going to do what he had already done elsewhere, which is to go to the local press and tell them what was going on. Now, at the time, of course, the limits of the local press were fairly small, right? There wasn't the national press that we have now, so that you didn't put something online and suddenly it's known globally. This in different places, so that even though he had already gone to the press in some places, he had not in others. And so the local folks didn't know what was going on. And Nick Gulas and Roy Welch, whom Tini worked for at the time and who ran several states in the South, Tennessee and Kentucky, Northern Alabama, sort of all over. They were terrified of Jack, and they gave him money. They paid up because they didn't want him to tell their secrets. But to Jack's dismay, at one point, they put Tini in charge of giving him his money. He was going to be, I think it might have been in Columbia, and anyway, it was a town in Tennessee that where she was the manager. And Nick and Roy said, "All right, Tini, Jack Pfeffer's going to show up, and here's the money that you need to give to him." And of course, Tini already knew what was going on. They had been paying him already, but she'd never really been involved in it. But it just tore her up, and she saw the wrestling business as really key to her financial situation. And of course it was her financial situation had improved greatly over the years because of wrestling. And she didn't want to see that go away. And she hated seeing someone take money from the business that she felt he didn't have any right to take. And so I'm going to leave the story there because it's a good one in the sense that it shows in terms of how Tini handled that situation. It shows a lot about her in terms of how much she felt about the business and how willing she was to sort of take matters into her own hands, as it were.
It's very gutsy, and it's pretty amazing.
It scared her to death. I mean, it scared her to death. Well, you know, it also, you know, things sort of got out of control as far as she was concerned with her temper, and it was not something that she was proud of. She was glad Jack Pfeffer went away, but she was really afraid of what she had done.
Yeah, especially when you consider, you know, possible mob connections or what have you. We're talking with Brennan Martin, new book out called Tini, Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame, about Christine Jarrett, the mother of Jerry Jarrett and the grandmother of Brennan and also the grandmother of Jeff Jarrett. And like I said, if it wasn't for her, there'd be no Memphis wrestling. Things would be dramatically different. It's a great story. We'll get into who Tini Jarrett was and the roles that she played coming up next. It's Wrestling Road Stories. It's Jim Valley every Wednesday here on the PW Torch Livecast.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
Wrestling Road Stories each and every Wednesday here on the PW Torch Livecast. Next week, by the way, next week is going to be a recorded show, but have I got something for you? I have dug up an old interview from 2001 with a guy who does not do interviews anymore. And no one knows exactly why. No one will say publicly why, but the belief is, and again, this is just a belief, the widespread belief is that, I don't know, maybe someone like Jerry McDivitt talked to him, perhaps, allegedly. We're going to have an interview from 2001 with Tom Zank. And if you remember that era, Tom Zank had no filter and talked about everything. So that's going to be, it's one of my old Total Chaos shows, which you can get if you're a VIP member here at The Torch. You can listen to all of the old Total Chaos shows, which are from like 99 to 2002-ish, somewhere in there. Even I forget sometime. But anyway, during that peak time of the WWF, I talked to so many different stars of that era. Many of them have passed on, including Lou Thesz and Road Warrior Hawk. But if you're a VIP member, you can listen to all of them. So next week, a very good sample of Total Chaos here with Tom Zank, which is going to be a lot of fun because you just don't hear about Tom Zank anymore for, I think, very apparent reasons that no one talks about. Well, let's get back to our live interview this week with Brennan Martin. Now, Brennan, every time, like, I would hear interviews with, say, with Jerry, or even, like, say, in various, in The Torch or The Observer, for some reason they would always refer to your grandmother as longtime ticket taker. And while that's certainly true, that doesn't really cover the whole scope of her duties. Can you talk about, you know, the role that she played in the Tennessee territory?
Yeah, sure. She started as a ticket taker, and she ended as a ticket taker. And ticket taking was part of what she did sort of throughout her career, but it was certainly much more than that. So going back to the beginning, she took a second job in 1946 on tickets to the matches in Nashville for Nick Ulis and Roy Welch. And then she sort of moved from there into becoming Nick Ulis's secretary. She then became a bookkeeper, and then really through her own diligence and because Nick and Roy were terrible at managing money, she essentially became, for lack of a better term, the CFO of Ulis Welch. She handled all of their finances, and it even got to the point where neither one of them were allowed to take a dollar out of the business without going through her. Of course, as things progressed with Jerry, and he eventually split away from Nick and Roy, she had no choice and really never even considered not going with Jerry. But by that time, she was not just managing the books for Ulis Welch, she was also managing towns. She started off in Columbia, Tennessee, and then managed several others that, you know, involved all of the promotional activities, not the booking. Jerry or Roy or whoever was booking at the time would do that. But she would hand, you know, she'd have the window cards created, she'd put them out, she'd manage all the relationships with the, in case of the spot towns, with the local JC, whoever was looking to raise money by, you know, through a particular event. She had all of the advanced.
You're breaking up a little bit, Brennan. I don't know if you moved or not, but you're breaking up a little bit.
I'm sorry to hear that. No, I haven't moved.
No, that's better. There we go. That's better.
Okay.
Keep going.
So, anyway, so she began having promotional responsibilities even before leaving Ulis Welch. And then when Jerry broke off, what they ended up doing, dividing the territory into two different businesses. So Tennessee was owned by Jerry and then eventually Jerry Lawler as well, who bought in. But Kentucky, which was under the Louisville Wrestling Enterprises moniker, was half owned by Teeny and half owned by Jerry. But at the same time, she had financed Jerry's entry into the business. And so she really had a lot to do with getting him started and then overseeing the financials and running the towns. She basically ran all the towns in Kentucky at that time. So whether it was, you know, Louisville and Evansville, of course, over in Indiana, Lexington once a month. And then when they weren't in Lexington on Thursdays, they were doing spot towns elsewhere. And then she also would sort of oversee things and sell tickets to the shows in Nashville, not because she was enjoying any of the profits there, but because she lived in Nashville. She loved the business, and she just wanted to be there. And so she was there every Saturday night and was really a fixture of that building there at the Nashville Fairgrounds and was after the business ran its course and McMahon had essentially won and driven out the territories. There's a story in the book about how she was eventually fired by the guy who took over Nashville wrestling for a while until he went out of business because he saw her as this old woman who did everything on pen and paper and he wanted to modernize. But then when he went out of business, Burt Prentice took over the promotion in Nashville again. And the first thing he did was hire Teeny back. And she sold tickets for Burt there in Nashville until just a few weeks before she died and before she entered the hospital and then eventually died. So she loved the business. And yes, she was a long time. She was a lot more than that.
And she was very much the disciplinarian. And this is one of the things that I noticed about her. There's so many books and so many tragedies in wrestling where this well-meaning person, whomever they are, whether it's a wrestler or what have you, you know, comes in and they're fairly innocent, and eventually they become corrupted by the wrestling industry, and they, you know, they end up a wrestling tragedy, and the road of wrestling is paved with those tragedies. But for everything, Christine Jarrett, and she wasn't, as you mentioned in the book, she wasn't particularly religious, but she had a very strong moral compass and very strong convictions. And regardless of whatever situation she was in, she was never tempted, and she never wavered. And I think that makes her a tremendous heroine in this book. And this is where I want to go with this, Brennan. Tell me Christine's four rules and why, the purpose of each rule.
Sure. So the first rule was be on time. And that had everything to do with the fact that she wanted the show to start on time. And she believed that whether the people were in the house yet or not, if you said you're going to ring the bell at 7:30, you ring the bell at 7:30. And at times she was questioned about that. And people would say, you know, Teenie, we still got 200 people outside in line. And her response to that was always, yes, but the people inside are our best customers. And we told them we're going to start on time, so we're going to start on time. So she insisted that the wrestlers be there an hour before the first bell so that they could get in, get ready, go over their match, and be ready to go. The second rule was no foul language. She believed that wrestling should be a family affair, and that it was the kind of thing that if there was foul language in the locker room, it would spill out into foul language on the floor of the arena and eventually into the ring and on the mic. And she felt that if the fans heard that, that they would stop bringing their kids, and she could only sell one or two tickets to a family that she could normally sell four or five to. So keeping a clean mouth was really important to her. The third rule was no arena rats. Stay away from them. Because she felt that these women who were coming in and trying to find themselves a rich husband were no good for the family image of the business, one, and also would only lead the wrestlers to ruin and sort of result in those types of tragedies that you mentioned and that she had seen too many times in her life already. And then the last rule was, again, related to the fact that she never broke kayfabe. And she absolutely insisted that the wrestlers never do so either. The bad guys were not to be seen on the floor. There would be no heels out signing autographs. There would be no baby faces and heels coming to the matches together or seen socializing out in public. She wanted them to maintain their personality and their character at all times. Because again, she felt that if that were not the case, if folks found out that what was going on wasn't 100% legitimate, that they'd stop coming. And she didn't want to see that happen.
Now, it's interesting because particularly the no foul language, talking about you want families to come. And I think there's kind of a disconnect between what Vince McMahon tries to promote and what a lot of people who read The Torch and other publications like that. You know, people, you see it every day online or you hear it or what have you. People, oh, bring back the Attitude Era, bring back the Attitude Era. That's when it was most popular, and that's, it'll get popular again. We just need to be able to do crude things and it'll be popular. And no, we're living in a different time, and Vince McMahon wants to sell tickets to families. And I think that's the same philosophy. And I'll tell you what, I obviously never knew your grandmother, but she seems like she had a warm side, but you also knew not to cross her.
Well, that's true. And what you mentioned about the Attitude Era, I mean, that was one of the reasons why she just could not bear Vince McMahon. I mean, she couldn't stand him. And the first you ever heard her to using foul language was every time she said his name, it came out, that so-and-so Vince McMahon. And that so-and-so was really the only curse word or close to a curse word you ever heard her say. You know, she didn't like him because he didn't respect the territory model, and she didn't like him because of the Attitude Era and what she felt he had done in terms of besmirching the family image of wrestling that she thought it should be. But, yeah, you're right. She was tough, and when wrestlers broke those rules, she let them know she wasn't happy. And she would employ what the wrestlers called the grip. And sometimes the grip involved, you know, it's just grabbing them by the earlobe and dragging them across the locker room. But very often it involved putting her hand on their chin and squeezing her thumb and fingers together on their cheeks so their lips kind of pooched out. She'd look them right in the eye and tell them what they had done wrong, and then she'd walk away. And I told the guys about that, and they said, yeah, that was, you know, that was no joke. She would do that, but she wouldn't hold a grudge. She would tell you what you did wrong, and then she'd move on. And I had the chance to talk with Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson recently. I was in Jackson for a show, and the Rock and Roll Express were there with Jim Cornette. And I asked Ricky, I said, Ricky, did Taney ever put you in the grip? And he said, absolutely not. And he said, we knew going in what her rules were, and we were not about to cross her. We knew better than that. So it wasn't just that, you know, she would do this, you know, they would flaunt the rules at her. They would occasionally forget, and they would not, you know, they would not soon forget after that.
We're talking with Brennan Martin, the grandson of Christine Jarrett. The book out is called Taney, Professional Wrestling's Grande Dame. I assume, get it on Amazon? Where all can you get it, Brennan?
Amazon's probably the easiest way to get it. If you have a Nook, you can get it through those channels as well. But it's available in both paperback and Kindle version. The paperback's $14.99. The Kindle's only $3.99. And there's a few other places where you can pick it up as well. And you can find those listed at the website, which is taneyjarrett.com. But Amazon seems to be where most people find it.
Well, I think it's a bargain at that price. And let me tell people, a lot of times you read books and they go over a wrestler's childhood or whatever, and you're like, I just don't care. I just don't care where you played basketball or whatever. This book is a lot of her early life, but as you're reading it, because you kind of know what Jerry Jarrett did and you kind of know what Jeff Jarrett did, there are, whether you intended it to or not, Brennan, there are hints in the book where you kind of go, oh. And then there are also things in the book, because you know certain outcomes, where it alludes to things. And it's I think it is a wrestling book, but it's also the story of a really strong woman who had very strong convictions. You know, she raised her kids virtually on her own. You know, she kicked her husband out at a very early stage, and, you know, and she went on to live the American dream as far as, you know, wealth and generosity and what have you. But it's a great book. We'll talk about it a little bit more. I got to take one more break here. We'll take some calls for Brennan and talk more about Memphis wrestling, which I love. I could talk Memphis wrestling all day. It's the PW Torch Livecast. I'm Jim Valley. It's Wrestling Road Stories, and we'll talk some Memphis wrestling next.
You love pro wrestling podcasts, but you might not have time to listen to all of them. We'll help you decide which ones to listen to and keep you up to date on the ones you're missing at pwpodcasts.com. That website features written recaps of all of the top pro wrestling related podcasts, including Steve Austin, Bruce Prichard, Edge and Christian, and so on. Check it out. It's pwpodcasts.com, your home for written recaps of all pro wrestling personality hosted podcasts.
The book is Taney, Professional Wrestling's Grande Dame, and we're talking to the author and grandson of Christine Jarrett, Brennan Martin. You know, Brennan, as I was reading the book, I was thinking, and this is a weird comparison, but let me make it anyway. It's almost like watching Little House on the Prairie, where you know that she's going to grow into Laura Ingalls Wilder, and you know where she's going. So, I mean, a lot of the early stories really kind of forge who she became and who she was, and she could have very easily, you know, gone off the track. She could have very easily been poor her whole life. She could have very, very easily, and it's she really is a remarkable woman, I must say.
I can say she came from good stock in the sense that her mother, Birdie, was an incredibly strong woman who really had to deal with an awful lot. Taney's father, who the family called Papa, was a drunk. He was a skilled craftsman, a very good paper hanger and painter, but he was a better drinker, or a worse drinker, as the case may be. But somehow Birdie managed to piece together a living for five children on a small salary, a small inconsistent set of paychecks from Papa, and still put money away. One of the things that Teeny really believed in was the importance of saving for a rainy day. And she got that from Birdie. Birdie would go to the bank every week and put away 25 cents, 50 cents. It didn't matter. She would somehow come up with money that she could save. And Teeny developed that sense of saving herself. And she did her best to try to instill it in the boys. I mean, she used to open up savings accounts for wrestlers who would, you know, the ones that she would have a closer relationship with, so that when payday came around, she would give them their money, often in cash, because it was very much a cash business at that time. And then she'd make them give her some money back, and she would put it in their savings book in the bottom drawer of her desk, that she would take it to the bank and make the deposits for them, because she knew that the money wouldn't last. She knew that, you know, they may be making money now, but it's not something that for most of them was likely to last forever. And she didn't want to see them spend it all. So she tried to instill that sense of saving that her mother gave her into the folks that worked for her as well.
Let's take a couple of phone calls here real quick. Questions from some listeners. Let's go to area code 240. 240, you're on the live cast. Who's this, and what's your question?
Name's Ryan from Cumberland. Question about Jeff Jarrett. Does he really write country music songs, or is that just a complete gimmick?
Well, I mean, you've heard him, and you've heard him sing. What do you think?
Well, they did the angle where Ray Dogg supposedly wrote the song, but I didn't know. Like, they always saw the guitars and Impact Wrestling, so it sort of confused me then when they carried it on.
I mean, let's put it this way. I've never heard Jeff sing outside the context of a wrestling show.
Okay.
Did he just shock your world, Ryan? You got any other questions for Brett and Barton?
The only other question I have is, what do you think of the Braun Strowman Karen Jarrett story? Do you think that was sort of made up by the dirt sheets?
Oh, he seemed to have dropped off. I think he has his poor signal. Let me see if he'll call back in here in a second, Ryan. I apologize for that, but he dropped off. Hopefully he'll call back in, but I appreciate your call there, Ryan, from Cumberland, Maryland. Let's see if we can dial him up again. He was kind of dropping out, so we'll see what happens.
So sorry about that, Jim. Not sure what happened.
It's cell phone technology. I don't understand.
I'm not sure where. Caller, so I apologize for that.
Oh, no big deal. Don't sweat it. Hey, I wanted to talk about in the book, and here's what I've decided for you, Brennan. Last week, I gave Tony Schiavone the million-dollar idea to print T-shirts up that say "The Greatest Night in the History of Our Sport" with his face on it, and he wanted to give me a cut, and I don't want a cut. And here's your million-dollar idea that I don't need a cut from. I just want full credit, okay?
Let's hear it.
Your next book, and you need to get on this, like, as soon as we hang up, I want you to get right on it. Your next book is the story of George Gulas.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
I spent a whole chapter on him. You'd want me to write a whole book?
Oh, my God. He's so fascinating. Okay, so everyone knows, here's what I knew about George Gulas, you know, being removed from the Tennessee territory. I knew that he was a terrible wrestler. And there's so little content of him on YouTube. There's very little, but what is there is pretty bad. I knew that, you know, like from the Memphis Heat and from Jerry Jarrett's autobiography talking about how Nick doted on him, but you get into details much more graphically. You know, I just thought he was kind of a lovable lunk who, you know, if Chris Hansen would go see him if he was of a certain, you need to write a book on George Gulas. I mean, you paint the picture of how George is 14 years old and he's at a basketball game and he's 14, and he's watching the entire game on the lap of his, I guess, babysitter, caregiver, whatever you want to call him. That's weird.
It was a little weird. Yeah, George was a special guy he had lots of advantages in life in the sense that he had a father who adored him, who was willing to spoil him rotten. But I'm not sure that always played to George's advantage. He is an interesting character. I'm not trying to say he's dead. I haven't had any exposure to George face to face since I was a kid, really since before the split between Jerry and Nick. But I did have interaction. It wasn't an interaction, but exposure to him in the sense that he was on the local news in Nashville one time because he had gotten caught twice in the same day in a prostitution sting, and he was willing to go on the air in a live interview and talk about it. So, yeah, George struggled with certain aspects of life.
Yeah, I think that that a wrestling book on George Gulas, but I just wanted to read. I was like, Teenie is this inspirational, hardworking, convicted woman who never gave in and always did the right thing. And then you have the complete opposite in George, and it's just one thing that I never understood. I mean, and you know, in the territorial days, I was a dumb Mark fan, and you look back at some of the things you liked or the wrestlers you like, and you go, wow, they were really terrible. For example, if you look at the early interviews of Sting, his interviews were terrible, but I thought he was the coolest guy. And it amazes me that someone was actually as bad that the for lack of a better term, was, you know, the Mark fans who believed it was still real to them, damn it, that George, that they could not buy into or like George.
Yeah, well, he didn't really have much of anything to offer to the fans. He wasn't, at least Sting could wrestle, right? I mean, he wasn't that bad of a worker, from what I recall. And he was, you know, he had a look about him. He had an interesting look. George was goofy looking, clumsy, couldn't really do an interview, and certainly couldn't wrestle. So there was just nothing for a fan to latch onto.
Here's what I think the book will give you, aside from all this background knowledge on Christine Jarrett. It will, if you're not from Tennessee and didn't grow up on Memphis, it will fill in exactly some of the intricacies of how the territory ran and sort of the business operations between Jarrett and Gulas and Welch, and kind of explain a lot of those things. There's a lot of details in there where I went, oh, I have a much better understanding of Tennessee now, because you fill in a lot of details before where in the past people just talk about, like George Gulas. People talked about him not being able to wrestle and being a mama's boy, but you provide details that are, well, they're just creepy, quite frankly. They're just freaking creepy.
Yeah, you know, it is sad, though, because Nick did love his son, and that really became Nick's downfall. And Teenie and Nick were very close. They had a sort of a brother-sister relationship, and it was hard on Teenie when Jerry split off because she loved Nick, and she hated to see what was happening. You know, she certainly understood that George was never going to be a success, and like I said before, I think she never even considered not going with her son. But it was a difficult time for her because she saw what it was doing to Nick.
Another great story in the book talks about how Nick Gulas and Roy Welch met. And that, I mean, again, that's really helpful, I think, if you're not, you know, overly familiar with the history of Tennessee and Tennessee wrestling. So there's not only is there a great story about Christine Jarrett, but there's a lot of great details in there that fill in a lot of the blanks that I had and some I didn't even know I had about pro wrestling. Can you stick around a little bit longer, Brennan?
I do. I do want to clear up the fact that I took considerable creative license with that meeting between George and Nick. So don't put too much historical stock into that.
Well, did they meet due to the wrestling bear, though?
No, they probably didn't. Roy did need Roy did need a promoter. Nick had worked some in Birmingham before, but Ginger the Wrestling Bear certainly did exist. Roy and Pat Malone had Ginger and trained her, and so I kind of wanted Ginger to be in the story, and it seemed like a good way to introduce Nick into the story. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning of the book, not everything is completely historically accurate in there, and that's one of the areas that it took some license.
I'm glad you're honest with that. You're good. I'm glad you're setting me straight on that. I didn't mean to make it awkward or anything, but it's good to have the bear in there, so you kind of see how the con worked. Well, let's take one more break here, and I want to talk to you just about some wrestling, some things that you liked growing up, maybe some things that you saw personally that we can talk about that maybe didn't pertain to the book. But we'll come back with Brennan Martin from the Jarrett Wrestling Family. It's Wrestling Road Stories. It's Jim Valley, and we are here every Wednesday on the PW Torch Livecast.
Don't just listen to PW Torch's brand of wrestling coverage. Read it, too, every day at pwtorch.com. Join me Monday nights for my live coverage of Raw, Tuesday nights for my live coverage of SmackDown, Sunday nights for my live coverage of WWE pay-per-views, and keep up on the news and read exclusive editorials and special features every day at pwtorch.com.
You know, one more thing I wanted to mention about Teeny, Professional Wrestling's Ground Down, the book. My wife is a big reader, particularly on vacation, and whenever I read these wrestling books, she always asks, well, would I enjoy this book? Should I read this book? And sometimes it's too inside baseball. There's just too much wrestling, and even though I've ruined my wife and she knows more about wrestling than she ever probably wanted or hoped to know, sometimes I'll go, yeah, you probably won't enjoy this book. It's probably not for you. But I think that pretty much anybody, whether you're a wrestling fan or not, could read this book easily. I think it's a great story, again, about a very strong woman, and I think it tells a great narrative. So whether you're a wrestling fan or not, I would definitely pick up Teeny Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame.
Thanks for saying that, Jim. I that's one of the reasons why I wrote it in the style that I did. As I call it a biographical novel, as opposed to a straight biography. And I did that because I wanted to make it more accessible to those folks that, you know, might not be interested in wrestling, but might nevertheless be interested in the story of a woman who went from a very poor childhood to really bringing her entire family into the middle class.
And she did it her way, as Frank Sinatra said. So when did you...
Absolutely.
Did you ever get any... you said you went on tour a couple of times, once with Teeny. Do you have any like firsthand stories that maybe you could tell that wouldn't be that weren't applicable to the Teeny Jarrett story?
Well, there's one that I can tell you about, which comes from that same circuit that I did, the Louisville, Evansville, Lexington tour, and it also relates to basically my inability to smarten up. But it was after Louisville, which is on Tuesday night. Teeny was good friends with Thelma Cornette, Jim Cornette's mother. And so rather than going back to Nashville, which Teeny occasionally did between each of those shows, we stayed in Louisville at Thelma and Jimmy's house. And Teeny and Thelma were downstairs talking, and I went up with Jimmy to his room to see his collection of wrestling memorabilia because, it was, although it's bigger now, he had a huge collection of stuff even then. And we were looking through some photo albums, and he had some pictures of Tojo Yamamoto was in a referee shirt, and there was some action shots going on that Jim had taken on like little thin, like those gymnastics mats that you used to tumble on at school, and it was clearly on like the floor of a basketball court. And I was scratching my head. I was like, this kind of looks like, what are they doing? Are they practicing? And this is the point at which Jim figures out that I haven't smartened up yet. And I can still remember the blood draining out of his face because he knows that Teeny would skin him alive. And that, if she wasn't going to do it, he absolutely couldn't do it. And he just backpedaled, and I don't remember. He said something about like, oh, well, you know, sometimes they have to, you know, these falls, they there's a certain way they take the falls, and they have to, you know, work on that to make sure they don't hurt themselves or something like that. That album quickly disappeared, and he broke out some wrestling programs or comic books or one of the other thousand things he had in the room and quickly diverted my attention to something else. But, yeah, that was one of those times when I should have, at that point, started to put two and two together. That whole trip was really about that.
And that's another side note in the book. You do talk about sort of the origin of Jim Cornette and the Jim Cornette character and Jim Cornette's mom. And I think people, I was vaguely familiar with how Cornette started, but I think it's good to get another set of eyes and another version to the story. And again, you provide some interesting details to sort of the origin of the Jim Cornette managerial character and the Mama Cornette character as well, where that all kind of germinated from.
Yeah, that all, you know, came from Jim. So that's definitely a part of the story that it very much follows the historical record in terms of what actually happened. Tini was a big fan of Jim from the start, and she gave him opportunities sort of every chance she got. And then, of course, it was Jerry who eventually pulled him into the ring, which Tini was a little concerned about that because she didn't want one of her favorite young men to get hurt, and she felt like he wasn't necessarily of the same type of physical stature as some of the wrestlers, but of course she couldn't do anything about it at that time. He was a grown man and could make his own decision.
So did you ever inquire about getting into wrestling, or did Tini ever warn you about not getting into wrestling?
No, I didn't. I really considered it, in part because I wanted to do other things, and in part because I think whether consciously or unconsciously, my mother kept me away from the business really as much as she could. There were one time I went on tour, and there was when I spent the time at the wrestling office, but my mother did not like the business at all. She never needed to be smartened up. She, from the moment she was a little girl, figured out it was fake and really wanted nothing to do with it, in part because she thought it was just silly and dumb, and in part because it was something that constantly took her mother away from her. And because Tini was a workaholic and always either at the office or on the road. And so my mother wanted nothing to do with the business. And I just it wasn't something that I ever really considered. I was fascinated by it in a lot of ways. And I enjoyed going to the matches on occasion, but you know, we didn't go every week by a long shot. I would watch on TV some, but I wasn't as enthralled with it as you might expect, considering the family that I grew up in.
And, you know, that's not unusual. I know Ric Flair's oldest daughter, Megan, is not a fan of wrestling because she sees it as it took her dad away from her. And, you know, he was always on the road as opposed to being a dad. And you know, I can certainly understand those feelings, and I think they're valid. But at the same time, I would say that, you know, her dad also made choices. But, you know, that's not an unusual thing for kids of the business. I think Dave Meltzer has talked about Bruiser Brody's son saying that, you know, aside from what happened to his dad, but, you know, you're always on the road. You never get to see family and things. So for some kids of the business, that's not an unusual perspective to have. So did you have any favorite wrestlers growing up?
I did. I was a big fan of Jerry Lawler, you know, and the folks that I liked tended to be the ones that Tini liked, right? So Tini loved Jerry. He always showed her the utmost respect. She loved Jimmy Hart. You know, I can remember seeing Christmas cards and birthday cards throughout my childhood from Jimmy, because he always paid her annual respect and showed her. He was just always very, very kind to her. And so Jimmy and Jerry, I both liked. I liked Bill Dundee because of really, it was funny because, you know, Bill and Jerry had their on-again, off-again feud throughout that time. But it never really mattered to me. I always, you know, liked them both. But beyond that, everybody loved Andre. And, of course, I did as well. I was fascinated by a man of that size. But then once Jimmy Valiant came along, he was really my man there for a while. I was a big fan of Jimmy, and it was a real thrill for me to recently get the chance to see him again at the county fair up near Elizabethtown, Kentucky. He made an appearance, and I got the chance to talk to him again, and so that was really fun.
You know, growing up, I didn't get Memphis TV up here in the Pacific Northwest, but, you know, we'd see Jimmy Valiant on Crockett, and that Jimmy Valiant was, well, that character was an idiot. And my friends and I just did not like Jimmy Valiant at all. And now I see the Memphis version of Jimmy Valiant, and I feel ripped off. I'm like, why couldn't I have that version? That version is much more complex and much more entertaining, as opposed to just clapping his hands and singing about, screaming about Paul Jones. Jimmy Valiant, the Memphis Jimmy Valiant, is definitely one of my favorites now in hindsight.
Yeah, he was a bad dude. You know, I really enjoyed him.
Obviously, as one of your grandmother's rules, stay away from the arena rats, you know, the women, the young women at the matches who are up for a good time. Granted, rats were very much a part of the business. Did people just go to greater lengths to hide that from Christine, or did they just avoid the women in those towns and then just have their women in other towns?
Oh, they absolutely hit it, right? It was always there. And there was also this tension between Teeny telling them to stay away and Jerry telling them to partake as much as possible. Because, you know, Teeny and Jerry had two different perspectives on how to bring the crowds in. For Jerry, it was, well, you know, sample the local talent, and that'll make more of the local girls think they have a chance. And the more of them show up, then the more of the boys will show up. So he was really going after kind of a different crowd than Teeny, who wanted it to be all about families. And so I've heard Jim Cornette talk about that a little bit on his podcast, but there was, you know, that was definitely an issue that was sort of a, like I said, a constant source of tension between Jerry and Teeny. But the boys absolutely, you know, that arena rats have always been part of the business, and in Teeny's towns, it was no different. They just had to be a lot more discreet about it.
Now, do you know, just by receipts or anything, did anyone give you a financial statement as far as which philosophy actually was more successful?
No, we ended up, my mother ended up with the books from the business when Teeny died, just because we are the ones that cleaned out her house. And so she was able to see a lot of the finances and see, you know, Teeny's contributions into the business, things like that. But we certainly never did any kind of forensic analysis. I would say that both of their two strategies, you know, likely contributed to the overall success that Memphis Wrestling and Louisville Wrestling enjoyed. They did very well for a long time. In large part because there were really two great minds working together to make it happen. Jerry is unquestionably a genius when it comes to booking and how he ran that side of the business. And Teeny, she also knew how to keep a crowd happy on her side of the business. So I think the two of them really made a good team.
I want to take one more quick break. We'll be back just a few more minutes with Brennan Martin and Teeny, professional wrestling's Grand Dame, when Wrestling Road Stories continues with Jim Valley.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. Thank you very much for your support.
Name of the book is Teeny, Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame. You can find it at Amazon, or you can also follow him on Twitter at TeenyJarrett.com, at TeenyJarrett, and that's T-E-E-N-Y, Teeny Jarrett. You can follow him on Twitter, and also the website is TeenyJarrett.com. Did your mom ever say, like, obviously Jerry Lawler was a big star. I know, for example, talking with Playboy Buddy Rose, that he always claimed, and this is probably true, that Don Owen told him that, you know, the people that made him the most money were Buddy and Lonnie Main. Did she ever have people that she said were the best and biggest draws?
you know, I don't ever remember her saying anything like that. I mean, Jerry Lawler was obviously, he was really the heart of Memphis wrestling, and that's why, you know, when he broke his leg, there was definite panic going on in terms of what they were going to do to keep the folks coming in while he recuperated from his weekend football game, where he ended up taking himself out of commission. But they figured it out. You know, they really started pushing Jimmy Hart as a manager and his first family, and Jimmy stepped up and was able to really carry the business during that time. So, you know, Lawler was definitely a big draw for, and meant an awful lot to the territory. But it was really, I think, as much about the total package and the storylines that they put together as it was about any one person.
I've seen pretty much all the Memphis wrestling that's up on YouTube, and I love Memphis wrestling. It makes me laugh that people back in the day would always criticize Memphis wrestling for its crazy characters and its crazy skits. And now when you turn on WWE, you see, well, not as much the crazy characters and skits, but definitely there has been a lot of that in WWE over the past, just maybe not exactly right at this moment. But you really have to admire the work that went into Memphis wrestling, the wrestling on a budget and relying on the creativity and the interviews and the presentation and Lance Russell and everything. It's just, I watch it, and so much of it, I just go, wow, this is just brilliant.
Well, that's what I mean about that total package. Memphis wrestling was a combination of that, you know, the gimmicks and the storylines and the feuds, but it was also about some very high quality work. And guys like Jackie Fargo, and going back even, you know, further than that, these were brawlers who were perfectly capable of defending themselves outside the ring, but who could get in the ring and deliver some very convincing matches that, you know, the fans just ate up. And you know, when I see wrestling today and I compare it to the matches that would go on back then, there's a difference, and there's a difference to me in the quality of the in-ring performance. And I think that that really spoke to, you know, that contributed a lot to the success of the business. I mean, these crowds were hot, and they were hot every week. It was amazing what they were able to pull off.
I mean, obviously your grandmother was about as universally loved as seems like anybody in the wrestling business could be, but certainly no matter how good you are, you may make the occasional enemy, whether you're right or wrong. Was there anybody who didn't want to talk in the book, or was there anybody who, I guess, would be considered an enemy of your grandmother, as surprising as that may be to hear?
Well, I'm not going to put anybody on the spot, but there were certainly, of the folks that I interviewed, there were a couple who were less fans of hers than others. You know, there's one guy in particular that I can think of who, again, I'm not going to call him out.
Okay.
But he didn't, you know, he just didn't care for her rules, and he didn't care for her sort of mother hen ways. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there were a lot of guys that probably felt that way. But they, at the same time, most of them knew when they were in her town, she was the one in charge.
Now, when I hear that, what I hear is from whomever you're talking about, and I respect your decision not to say any names, but what I hear personally is I wanted to party and go crazy and have rats ride the, you know, that's what I hear, is that she impeded on my fun. And to me, the business wasn't about making money. The business was about me partying. That's what I hear.
Well, that's, I think, a pretty accurate interpretation of what I was saying. I mean, these were guys who definitely, you know, they felt her wrath. They got, you know, scolded by her, and they didn't like it.
Did you ever get the grip?
No, I didn't. I was a good kid. I mean, I was a pleaser. I didn't like getting in trouble. I've kind of always been a rule follower. And so, no, I steered clear of that. I was a good boy.
Yeah, I pretty much am too. It sucks, but I pretty much am. So. All right, well, look, Brennan, I've really enjoyed it. For people who may be on the fence, give them a little plug. What do you think the story of your grandmother is about, and why should people pick it up?
Well, I think it's, you know, at its essence, it's the story of a woman who succeeded against many odds that were not in her favor at a time when single mothers just didn't tend to succeed in business, and in an environment you just don't see many women really excel, at least outside the ring. And so I think she is a very unique personality, very interesting environment, who lived her life the best way she knew how and provided for her family, and in the end did some amazing things for a lot of people.
What did your dad, or what did Jerry Jarrett say that he got from Teenie as far as advice, you know, as far as a life philosophy? What did he think the most important lesson was he learned? And same thing about Jeff. What do you think he got from Teenie?
I think what stands out for me that Jerry talked about was the respect for the fans. Teenie, she was fans of wrestling fans, and she developed relationships, you know, not just with Thelma Cornette, but with lots of the people who would come to the matches every week. And so Jerry, from an early age, learned from her that you really need to respect the fact that these people are coming and they're giving you their money, and that it's your responsibility to put on a good show. And Jeff, I think, learned from her how important the promotion side of the business is. I mean, he took more trips with her, quite a bit more than I did, and she would send him putting out window cards in small towns and things like that. And he learned how hard that was, but how essential it was to do that of the fan base, to get out there and get the word out that you can't just put on a show and expect people to show up. You've got to promote it.
Again, the name of the book is Teenie, Professional Wrestling's Grand Dame. It's on Amazon. You can follow him on Twitter at Teenie Jarrett. That's T-E-E-N-Y Jarrett. You can also find the Twitter handle. You can find it on my Twitter at Jim Valley. And again, the website is teeniejarrett.com. Lots of good stories from professional wrestling. I think there's some pieces in there for professional wrestling historians that will help you out. And again, in this day and age, I think it's also, like he said, a story of a strong woman who succeeded against all odds. So she really kind of lived the American dream.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Hey, man, it's my pleasure, Brennan. Let's get you on again anytime you want to talk some more wrestling. And hopefully, maybe if there's ever another fan fest in Charlotte or some other place, or Cauliflower Alley, again, you come on out. Let's you and I get together and grab dinner or coffee sometime.
I'd enjoy that. My next scheduled appearance right now is going to be in Winston-Salem the weekend after Thanksgiving for WrestleCade. So if anybody's listening and finds themselves in North Carolina the weekend after Thanksgiving this year, I'd love to see you come on out.
Yeah, I'm sure my friend Brett Wilberton and also Bob Keller, they'll come and see you, and I'm sure a lot of people will, because I know that people that were at the Charlotte Fan Fest go to WrestleCade, and I've been at Charlotte a couple of times, so hopefully people will listen, will come out, and if you haven't bought the book already check it out. So I'm looking forward to your next book about Gulas, and more importantly, George Gulas. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Don't hold your breath, but we'll see.
That's your next million-dollar project. I'm telling you, I just wanted more George Gulas when I was done with this book. I was like, I want more creepy George Gulas stories.
You're a glutton for punishment, Jim.
Yes, yes, I am. All right, man. Thanks, Brennan Martin. Thank you for joining us. Next week on the show is going to be a recorded interview with Tom Zenk. Tom Zenk from 2001 and my Total Chaos show. And then I'll be back the week after that, maybe. I'm not even sure with whom, but we'll figure something out. Either way, it's Wrestling Road Stories. Please share it on your social media outlets. Let people know that this is a cool show where we're always telling crazy stories about something to do with the wacky world of professional wrestling. So Until next time, remember, as always, you don't have to be white, white trash.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s. But you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject, and it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Killer Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the SE Editor format of the Weight Killer Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Past Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the livecast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.